Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, let's take a look at the week in politics. Never a quiet week, by the way. Always something going on. And joining me is Democratic political strategist Richard Gordon. He's been in this business for over 30 years. He's helped lots of candidates muddle their way through difficult issues. So always a great person to talk about. Richard, welcome back to the podcast. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, of course, the Neil Gorsuch appointment is, you know, the big news going on in this week. And, as we talk now, we don't know whether the nuclear option will get triggered. I think it will get triggered. Talk to me about the – you're also a lawyer. I mean, talk to me about the implications of what this means. Or is it, as some would say, no big deal? We blew the nuclear option when it came to lower federal court positions. We're just taking it to the next step.
Well, I think it is a huge deal. I think it's a tremendous deal, and I think it destroys an institution that has been one of the greatest American institutions for over 200 years. I think it's a tremendous mistake. Let's go back first and talk about what the Democrats did when they were in the majority. As you may recall, the Republicans were not allowing any Democratic judicial appointees to be put on the bench. And in fact, when President Obama left the bench, there were over 100 that still were not filled. And so the Democrats allowed for a simple majority to put them on. It's significantly different when we're talking about the United States Supreme Court. And to allow a Supreme Court justice for the first time in our history to go on by a simple majority is a major mistake. For the Republicans also to do this, they're going to have to live with the consequences. We're all going to have to live with the consequences. So I think this is a completely different situation than we had when the Democrats did it. Personally, I think there are issues for when we did it also. But it's just a larger condition of we just don't care about institutions that have worked for many, many, many years. And I think that is a real problem.
When you say we're going to live with this forever, I mean, and I've been asked this question, people have said, why can't you reverse the rule? Why can't they do it? And then if they choose to put it back? And I think the answer is that it takes a majority to do what they're about to do, which is to go nuclear. But it takes 3/5 to put the rule back. And that's the issue, that never would you have one party enough in control or that much agreement to sort of get the rule put back. Is that
right.
Kind of the explanation?
That is the problem. I mean, to be perfectly blunt with you, I think Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer really need to sit down and figure out what type of Senate they want to have. Because if you eliminate this, we don't know what the future is going to bring for either party. We don't know who's going to be nominated by this president, the next president, and whatnot. It will be very different to put the genie back in the bottle. And look, we're still fighting wars since 1985 over Robert Bork. So, I mean, this is the outgrowth of all of that. To put the rule back will be extraordinarily difficult. And it's going to be extraordinarily important for the right justice, which leads to a whole discussion whether the Democrats are doing the right thing here, because the next justice, whoever Trump puts up, if there is another appointment in his term, could be significantly worse than Neil Gorsuch. And we're now in a situation, if they lift the filibuster, then what do the Democrats do? There are no options at that point.
Neil Gorsuch himself, you know, a lot of money is being spent, millions of dollars being spent. I understand $10 million. In ads all over the place, basically telling people, call your senator, tell him to put Gorsuch on the court. Very, very few ads on the other side, but that of course, is just a reflection of where the money goes. As you listen to Gorsuch through the hearings, he didn't sound like a right-wing crazy person. Everything was, got to look at the law, got to honor precedent. Why the concern? They kept pointing to these two cases Democrats did about the guy in the truck who, you know, had an option in a winter storm. We don't have to go through the whole case, but the bottom line is sort of saying, look, the guy did the right thing. He lost his job, and Gorsuch said he should be lost. In another case involving an autistic child where Gorsuch's decision essentially getting overturned by the Supreme Court didn't reflect the rights of the autistic child. Gorsuch's answer is, it hurts me when I have to, you know, do something like that to an individual, but I have to follow precedent. I mean, did he strike you as somebody who was ultra conservative, some Democrats saying, oh, he's even more conservative than Scalia. He didn't sound that way.
Well, first of all, I cannot tell you what he said because I don't think he said anything. I think he was a master of saying virtually nothing. He seems like a very nice man. People I know who know him tell me he's an incredibly nice man. But he never said anything. He didn't have a view on anything. If you listen to what Senator Leahy of Vermont said, he said never in his history, never in his time on the Judiciary Committee has he heard someone say as little as this nominee has said. Having said all of that, I disagree with him on a multitude of issues, but that's not the decision on who gets to go to the court and who doesn't. We have gone to a point where we are using our judgment over the president's as far as who should be on the court based on where they fall on certain issues. That has never been the criteria for putting justices on the court, nor should it be here. Listening to him, he doesn't sound like a crazy person. I'm actually somewhat concerned who the next person is going to be, who yeah. I could be even more crazy. He sounds like a normal, justice to me. He is rather conservative. I disagree with him on a multitude of issues.
But you agree that it sounds like he does deserve to be on the court. It's a Republican president. To the winner go the spoils, and this is who we picked.
Well, I think Judge Garland deserves to be on the court, is what I truly believe. And I think what the Republicans did was an absolute disgrace in not letting an extraordinarily competent, qualified person to serve, and someone who is very much more in the mainstream in judicial thinking than Mr. Gorsuch is.
Well, and that was, Richard, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that was an issue. Look, Mitch McConnell took a gamble on that one, right? When he wouldn't let Garland be heard because of the rule he completely fabricated, which is we don't have nominees in a presidential election year. It's just nonsense. But at the same time, I also recall McConnell when being asked, well, look, when Hillary's president, you know, what are you going to do then? And he actually referred to the fact that, you know, we may very well go another 4 years without the seat being filled. I mean, he was making it very clear that he was not about to allow a Democrat to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court, unless my memory's wrong. But I think that's my memory.
Which is totally inappropriate. And, you know, I think Mitch McConnell should understand his job, and his job is not to stop everything that a Democratic president wants to do, which is what he did with President Obama. Having said all of that, look, is Gorsuch qualified to be on the court? Absolutely. There is no doubt. You may disagree with him on policy positions. You may disagree with his interpretation of the law. But that doesn't mean he's not qualified to serve on the court. He's eminently qualified and has the proper temperament, and it doesn't appear there's anything in his background that makes him not to be, you know, able to serve on the court as other people, you know, the Haynesworth or the Carswell nominees back many, many years ago. That's very different. That is usually the test. Gorsuch is qualified and deserves to be on the court, even though we may disagree with him.
I also think that, you know, I've heard some Democratic strategists say, you know what, Democrats, just hold your fire. Let this one go because you're not changing the balance of the court. But if, as rumor has it, Anthony Kennedy retires at the end of the summer, or if Ruth Bader Ginsburg at age 83 doesn't quite make it through 4 years before she retires, the next appointment is the one that truly changes the balance on the court. So hold your fire for that one. Now, my sense of that, Richard, is, and I said this on our WGN Morning News, you know what? McConnell's going to pull the nuclear option whenever he needs to. So even if he didn't do it now, he will do it then. There is absolutely no reason to think that if Democrats let him have this one, that next time around he'll go, oh, okay, I'll play nice. He's going to pull it whenever he needs to.
I think that's right. And that goes back to my point about why I think the McConnell-Schumer relationship is the key to everything, and why I think McConnell and Schumer really need to figure out a way of how to run the Senate. Because that, what you just described, is no way to run the greatest deliberative body in the world. We have to get away from that, and we have to find a way to do that. I agree with you. You know, if the Democrats back down now and don't the nuclear option is not put forward, McConnell could do it anytime he wants to do it, and he will do it again. The key here, the true key here, is for Democrats to win in 2018, and at that point have the opportunity to stop judges because they'll be able to filibuster and whatnot.
But, Richard, since you put that out there, look, 2018 is not the Democrats' year for taking things over, right?
It's a very hard year.
It is mostly Democratic seats that are up for defense. So if they were going to take it over, it was going to be 2016 when many Republicans were up. They don't have that chance in 2018.
Not only is it a tough year because of numbers, if I'm correct, I think the Democrats have 25 out of the 33 seats are up, but they're in extraordinarily difficult places. North Dakota, Indiana, Missouri, they're in very, very hard, they're very hard seats. But Democrats have been banking for a long time on that Trump's numbers and Trump's favorability is going to be so incredibly low that it's going to be good for Democrats. His numbers are low, but we're not seeing the type of erosion that would lead to a big change in the United States Senate or in the Congress 2 years from now. But that is the Democrats' strongest hope, which isn't much.
Let me just turn the topic over for a little minute to Jared Kushner, who seems to be the vice president of everything. Literally, he's in charge of Iraq, apparently. I imagine Afghanistan is part of that deal. China, Mexico. He's supposed to evaluate all corporate companies to figure out, and government agencies, I should say, to figure out how to cut the flak there. There is nothing that Jared Kushner is not running. And I think it's fair enough to say he's pretty much the CEO of America. I'm not being facetious. I'm not being partisan when I say that. It's pretty clear what the president is doing. The Republican response is, hey, Jared Kushner is the one ear the president listens to, so it's a good thing. Let him do it. Others would say he has absolutely zero experience and qualifications to do what he's doing. What are we doing? What's your take?
I find Jared Kushner one of the scariest things going on in America today. I'm sure he is a wonderful real estate person. I'm sure he knows a lot about running newspapers or whatever his business interests are. This is not an on-the-job training position. This is one of the most important positions in the world. That's not an exaggeration. This is the security of the world, and we are sending – he's 36 – but at 36, other people have done. Look at Jeremy Bash, for example, who used to be chief of staff to Panetta at Defense and at CIA. At the same age, that's a person who really had knowledge, really had expertise, and really could do things to help the country. You look at Mr. Kushner, has no experience with anything, and we're sending him into the most sensitive places in the world. This is a massive mistake. Not only that, but we have to start talking about who is President Trump talking to. The only people it appears he is talking to, because he's clearly not talking to his Secretary of State, is his son-in-law, his daughter, Steve Bannon, and a very, very, very small group of his personal lawyers and people like that, extraordinarily wealthy people who have no touch with what's going on in America. We are headed towards a major catastrophe if the President of the United States is not getting the type of information he needs. I respect the fact that the President should have the advisors around him that he wants. I respect that. But can we find someone with a little experience, a little knowledge, who knows what's going on? That's the danger of Jared Kushner.
As you know, his supporters don't leave him no matter what he does, no matter what he says. So does it take a true international crisis that gets bungled to modify things, or for that matter, if North Korea gets out of hand, do his supporters just continue to grow and say, hey, here's the best guy to handle it?
Dear God, I hope it doesn't lead to that, because that would be awful for everybody. It's fascinating to me, and I know you and I have had discussions in the past about why his supporters are just so locked in. It is baffling to me. I don't think his supporters leave him no matter what happens. I think the only way they leave him is, a massive turn in the economy, and his supporters get hurt first, because those are the people who are going to get hurt first in a recession, the people who voted for him, not the Jared Kushners or the billionaires of the world. I don't know how they lose faith in him, because they are so locked in. I think the only way is if there's some economic downturn that affects them, because they don't seem to care what's going on. But I sure as heck hope it's not something awful that happens catastrophically around the world.
Well, I think you're right. I think, listen, he's the jobs president. God's never made a bigger job creator, and you're right. When 2018 comes around, if the folks in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin who trusted in that promise find out that they're still not working and that the coal jobs weren't what they were all, you know, held up to be, then yeah, maybe that's what it takes for people to step around and just going, you know what, he's not meeting his promises.
But Paul, what worries me about that, I agree with you completely, but what worries me completely about that, and this is, to tie this all together, the Democrats in the Senate have to be so careful, because what he is going to do is blame the Democrats for absolute. I would have done the coal jobs, but I couldn't. I would have done the job stimulus in Ohio, but they stopped me. That's where they're going to go in 2018. That is their only argument. And the Democrats have to be very careful to show that they are the party that is leading this country to other things and has a path forward that he's not doing. That's the dichotomy that has to happen between the parties.
Democratic strategist Richard Gordon, the good news is we'll get to touch base again in the future to see just how right your sense of all this is, and we'll know in the next year. Thanks for being with me as always, my friend, and we will see you again soon here and, of course, on my Politics Tonight television show. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks so much. Bye now.
If I could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger.
And oftentimes in the second part of our podcast, I often turn to theater and the arts. But, of course, many of you who listen to me or know me from a variety of things that I do know that I have an incredible passion for animals and the treatment of animals. And I came across an organization I should have known about much sooner than I did, called the Morris Animal Foundation. I actually came across it because my dog sitter, yes, I have a dog sitter, so now you know where I fit in all this. She babysits when I'm out. Anyway, the dog sitter had done a walk for Morris Animal Foundation. I supported her, and it led me to sort of learn more about what this entity is. I always thought Morris was about Morris the cat, but I was wrong about that. And so it's important, I thought, for you guys to know what this great foundation is doing, not just for dogs, for cats, but for wildlife throughout the world. They're really doing some amazing stuff. Dr. Kelly Deal is joining me. She is the vice president in charge of, we're just going to say, scientific research. You know everything going on in the sciences tied to all this, Kelly, and thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here, Paul, and I really appreciate the chance to chat with you about an organization we both have a lot of love for, which is Morris Animal Foundation.
And I think, again, whereas this was new to me, which it should not have been because I track all of this kind of thing, let's make sure our listeners get up to speed as well. First of all, let's just go to the name. It's not Morris the cat as much as I wanted it to be. Talk to me about when the Morris Animal Foundation started, and indeed, it is about a family named Morris.
You're correct with that, and you're not the first person to make that mistake. So we were a foundation started by Dr. Mark Morris Sr. back in 1948, so we're coming up on our 70th anniversary, which is amazing.
Fantastic.
And Dr. Morris actually was a small animal practitioner back in the day when that was just really starting to be recognized, right? He started in the late 1920s, early 1930s. Prior to that, as you know, veterinary medicine had been very focused on farm animals and horses, and we still do horses, but Dr. Morris was interested in small animal. So he started the foundation based on some research he did in his practice. And for those of you out there who have probably heard of Science Diet and Hill's Science Diet, that was really Dr. Morris's, he was instrumental in founding that. And he was one of the first people to link nutrition in small animals to diseases. And he, again, made one of the first prescription diet for kidney problems in dogs. And it was out of that that he decided, you know, we need some really more, just more scientific research that's based on animal health problems and concerns of animals, particularly companion animals like dogs and cats. So he started the foundation, and we've been funding studies that look at animal health problems dogs, cats, we do horses, and as you mentioned, we do wildlife as well.
So I want to focus in a little bit on each of those areas. Let's start in the dog and cat world, because most of our listeners, they probably don't have horses at home. Some might, but they might not have a horse, and they might not have elephants as well. But almost everybody, I think, has dogs and cats and birds and those kind of things. So in terms of the focus, and you guys send me research and study reports. A lot of what you do is fund the research of other researchers, right? It's not as though everything is going on under your roof. You're working with other groups to help them continue their work.
Right. That's absolutely correct. And for a long time, that was our model, that researchers would come to us. In fact, we are one of the largest funders of animal health research in the world. We're proud to be able to say that because, as you know, funding for animal health problems is pretty slim. And so researchers would come to us with a problem. We need to learn more about, now I know this is going to strike at your heart, calcium oxalate stones and schnauzers. And there's not a lot of money out there to study that. We would be the organization. We funded a lot of studies looking at, that's just one example.
And in fact, I've seen reports on that. You guys are doing that. I mean, I have schnauzers. Most people know that about me, that I love those guys. And yeah, and then who else would study that specific issue and that specific kind of dog? But by the way, and you're welcome to talk more about it, you do the same thing for golden retrievers. I mean, there's just all sorts of specific breeds that have particular problems.
Right, absolutely. And so there are, for some of these problems, they're very niche issues, right? They may not have, some of the work we do may have broad applicability across several breeds of dogs, but some don't. So people can come to us with if they have a great study, and we hopefully can fund them and in their research. So sure, the schnauzers are one. But you did mention our model, which has been to this point funding outside studies. The Golden Retriever Lifetime Study Project, which you alluded to, golden retrievers and their issues,
right,
is one of the first studies and that we are actually managing in-house. So what we did is recruit 3,000 golden retrievers. We're following them through their lifetime. But specifically, we have cancer endpoints that we're looking at, and we're looking at their genetics and where they live and what they eat. I mean, there's this huge, huge, I think it's over 100 pages questionnaire that owners fill out every year that, I mean, it looks at what kind of flooring do you have in your house? What's your primary heating source? What's your secondary heating source? We have them all these dogs GPS, so we know where their environment is. They have to provide the genetics. And that is a study we're sort of managing in-house. We have people obviously working in the field, lots of veterinarians we work with, lots of owners. We have, as our investigator that's overseeing the project, Dr. Rod Page, who's an extremely well-respected veterinary oncologist at Colorado State University, and we're working together, but we are sort of managing that project in-house, and that's something new for us.
One of the things I also wanted to mention, by the way, in the giving end of things, I do research. If I'm going to talk to a charity or something like that, I won't mention names, but there are charities where when you look at what they do with the money, 80% of it goes to marketing and administrative expenses, which I think is inappropriate. And then a small amount of that money goes to, be it research or whatever. There's some actually pretty famous charities, not just in the animal world, but in other worlds, the veterans world. People ought to do their homework before you give money and find out what percentage of those dollars actually goes to the work and the research, and not just sending people on chartered planes all over the country. That was one of the things that impressed me about you guys, because when I looked at where it went, I know it varies from year to year, but I think it's a fair enough number to say about 80% of the money that comes into you guys goes actually for your program work, and that when you look at the charity giving ratings and all of that, that puts you at the upper end of everything.
Right, and that's something we're very proud of, and we try to very hard to be cognizant of that we're not using our donors' money towards, like you said, we're not flying people in the corporate jet anywhere. We'd love a corporate jet, but we don't have.
I'd love a corporate
right
jet
now.
Too, by the way.
See, yeah, right, exactly. So we don't do that. What we're using right now, and I'm talking with Lori Peterson, who you've met here, who's our vice president of development. And Lori quickly wrote down, you know, 100% pretty much of what we take in goes to programs, and we use the interest from our endowment to cover our operating expenses.
Ah, so important. And so, again, there's the dog research and the cat research, which we all relate to on a daily basis. But when I first began to talk to some of the folks in your organization, Sarah was my first connection and who introduced me to things. I said, you know, but I also have a passion. I read about the poaching in Africa and the vicious attacks on elephants and rhinos and all the and wildlife out there. Do you guys do anything there? And sure enough, the answer was, indeed, we do.
Yeah, we do a lot of wildlife research, and it takes the whole gamut. We've done over 300 different species of animals. So it can take the form of, you brought up some endangered species. We have a fair number of endangered species, and we're not conservation per se. We're looking at their health risks. So you brought up some things. In Africa, we've done a lot of work with elephants. We've looked at some of the diseases of African lions. There's a great deal of problem with, as you probably have heard, with when, as humans encroach into wildlife areas, there's crossover of diseases. We're seeing, for example, canine distemper, okay, a viral disease that we have a very effective vaccine for. Well, it's spilling over into animals we never thought could get it. For example, we did research with a group in Siberia looking at tigers who, if you can believe it, are getting distemper, canine distemper. And, of course, these are populations that are very fragile, right? These are bacteria or viruses, sometimes bacteria, that they've never been exposed to. So it's a very novel and very vulnerable population. And so these are big problems that we've looked at. You know, as far as some of the issues with poaching, some of what we do will cross over into that, though that's not a specific area of focus for us right now. But again, anything health-wise, we've seen it in contact with gorillas. They're picking up, if you can believe it, respiratory diseases from people, and sometimes even well-intentioned people, people who are going to look at tourists, right? There's
right.
a lot of ecotourism, and they can bring in diseases that these gorillas are not have never been exposed to because they've never really come in contact with humans like this. So we've done a lot of that. We had two studies we did recently, one on San Joaquin kick foxes, which are these cute, adorable sort of population of foxes that, as you can imagine, live in California, San Joaquin Valley, and they're getting under, coming under a lot of pressure from development because we know there's a lot of development there, and they're susceptible to mange. So we know about mange.
Wow, yes.
Mange in our dogs. We hardly ever see mange in our domestic population, but it's a huge problem for them, and it's putting a lot of pressure on a very vulnerable population. So, yes, we do. I think a lot of people think of us as dogs or cats, but we do a ton of wildlife research as well, and, again, a huge, huge variety of species.
And I should say, you're right, I did mention the poaching thing. I knew you guys weren't involved in that. It just tugs at my heart. But the point is, it is related because, it, you know, when poaching happens or, you know, inappropriate killing happens, you're lowering the population. And that is that's not very helpful when you also have your efforts to try and assist in disease prevention and disease diagnosis. If we could cure the disease end, the numbers would increase on some of these species of animals. And this all sort of works together as one joint piece of preserving wildlife as we know it. And as we can appreciate it, because the last thing we want to do, I think, is have to take our kids to the zoo one day and go, hi, that's called an elephant. They used to be in the wild.
Right, right, absolutely, right. They're all really interdigitated, aren't they?
So very much so.
Issues, and again, it comes down to sometimes the human interface, the encroachment into territories that before these animals would not have even been accessible to people very easily.
Yeah. So you guys, you have to raise money to do what you do. And again, the way, as I mentioned, my dog sitter got involved in was, I think, a virtual walk. Just give me a sense of how it is. Obviously, people can donate to you, but are there events, different ways that people want to get involved with you guys? How do they do that?
Well, there's a couple ways. We have some campaigns. In fact, we're getting ready to launch our spring campaign, which coincides with, as you may know, May is Pet Cancer Awareness Month.
Yes.
So in the spring, we always do Unite to Fight Pet Cancer. And so we're getting geared up for that campaign, which will be in May and June. And you can go to our website. You can call us directly. And we can help facilitate a donation, and we're getting ready for that. We're getting ready in the fall. We have another Season of Hope campaign, which is, of course, our end-of-the-year campaign. You can go to our Facebook page. You can go to our website. You can even call us, and we'd be happy to help people donate. We have monthly donors, so just like you would for your public radio, we have donors that have mentioned us in their estate planning. We have donors who do, you know, when they get our new, we send out a quarterly newsletter, they send us what they have. And
yeah,
we have donors who do all levels. We are happy to take everything we have, you know, the whole gamut of donors. And so we have donors who sponsor studies specifically because they're very interested, like you are, in schnauzers.
And I think that's what... Yeah, that's what's so critical. I mean, it's people that, you know, whenever you're donating, and some people say, well, I can only give $10. I only have $20. But you know what? That's just great, because there are many diseases that could be eradicated if lots of people gave $10 or $5 or $20. And when you can give $100, you know, you do what you can. I know you guys have, one of the things that attracted me was you have an In Loving Memory wall there in your foundation in Denver, but also it's a way to just have a, you know, if you miss one of your pets, as I do, you can make a donation and have them memorialized, you know, in writing on the wall in so many different ways. But that money is always going to help fund additional research. In fact, I'm making modifications to my will so I can assist you guys in the future, even after I'm not around, because I just believe in maintaining our wildlife and doing what we can for them. The website is morrisanimalfoundation.org, right?
Yes.
MorrisAnimalFoundation.org. And, you know, it is true. I have to say, when I first had questions, I called. I'll tell you, you guys are so responsive. You send me stuff. You let me know what the research is. You want me to know what's going on. Maybe other organizations do that, but I just found you guys to be especially responsive, and it's one of the things that triggered my keen interest in what you do. And I know the support of my WGN colleague, Steve Dale, as well, who's the pet maven of all pet experts around, and he appreciates all that you do as well. Kelly Deal, I want to thank you for your time. Give my best to your colleagues at the Morris Animal Foundation. Once again, the website is morrisanimalfoundation.org. Help them out. Check them out. You know what? Don't listen to me. Check them out. See the kind of work they're doing. If you are passionate about dogs and cats and wildlife and curing diseases and getting the answers to some of these diseases, this is the organization that is truly a leader in funding the road to the cure in so many. Kelly, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Paul. I really appreciate you having me on, and we really appreciate your support here, and I'm so glad I had the opportunity to talk to your audience about the great work we do.
Same here as well. Dr. Kelly Deal, brilliant in all that involves research in animals. Thanks for your time, and we'll hope people will check you out. Thanks for being with me.
All right. Thank you so much.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.